The human spirit is unconquerable. We are individuals and we are sovereign, born with unlimited potential, gifted from our creator. Our mission is to break free from the systems that bind us.
I volunteer as tribute.
We strive for peace and prosperity and overcome all challenges, roadblocks, and obstacles. We are empowered because we think for ourselves and we act for ourselves. We are self-reliant and independent, but guided by the wisdom of those who share our values.
What possible difference can I make?
There is no government, no ruler, nor ideas that are able to stop us. We are driven to succeed because we seek political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
It's all for nothing if you don't have freedom.
This is Mike Corbell, and you are listening to The Invictus Mind.
Well, hey there, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Invictus Mind. This is obviously your host, Mike Corbell, because if it were not, you would not be listening to this podcast. The holiday season has approached us fast, as it always does. Feels like just yesterday was Halloween, and in 2 weeks it's going to be Christmas. Hopefully you got all your shopping done, because there's nothing more stressful than waiting till the last minute to buy those gifts that you've been planning to do for the last month. Of course, I don't know anybody who actually goes anywhere to shop anymore. I do almost all of mine online. I really don't care about giving Jeff Bezos my money. It's just so much easier to have that little box dropped off on your doorstep. But I digress. I don't believe this will be the last episode this year, and I know that you're all expecting me to be more consistent with releasing these. I eventually will. I just need to get better with scheduling. But I got a lot of cool stuff coming up before the holidays, and on top of that, I'm going to Orlando again. That's right, right after New Year's, I'll be down there doing some video work for the financial firm I work with. And in the meantime, I'm going to be creating my portfolio, building my website, and writing a marketing plan for 2022. As a matter of fact, this weekend, I'll be attending a great event that is designed to help entrepreneurs create a vision and set in motion the things they need to do to be able to do the things that they want to do to build a life of autonomy. That's right, Jason Stapleton is hosting his Discover 2022 webinar with the people of the Nomad Network and all the other guests who have attended. If you want to attend, you can just go to Discover 2022 under Jason Stapleton and find the link. I just don't have any other endorsements for that right now. But I'll also be working with Mark Clare from the Lions of Liberty podcast. He is starting his own podcast consulting practice, and of course, he is one of the best in the industry and has had one of the earliest podcasts that I know of in the Liberty space. So there will be new changes coming to this show starting in 2022. I don't know exactly what they will be, but it's always a good thing to be learning new skills and putting them into practice. So hopefully, if you enjoy this show, you will continue listening in the future. If you do like this show, I appreciate it if you would share it with three of your friends, as that's the only way that we can grow. I will be continuing to bring on interesting guests, like the one I am sharing with you today, and yes, occasionally doing solo episodes, talking more about myself and what skills I bring to the table. Okay then, without any further ado, I'm going to introduce the friend who I interviewed last week. This is going to be a good one. We talk about his experience in the legal profession, the changes coming because of technology in the legal system, finding good advocates for your protection, and the value adds that attorneys can give to their clients. Coming up next is my discussion with my friend Alex. Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Invictus Mind podcast. This is your host, Mike Corbell. We have a discussion this week. Last week was a holiday week, so we didn't get to connect with my guest because of Thanksgiving holiday. And so I wanted to invite my friend Alex on. I've actually known him for several years, and I'm going to ask him to introduce himself a little bit. But we met in the Libertarian Party. I believe it was back in 2017, right, Alex?
Somewhere around, it might have been even before that. That was when I moved out to Indiana. So it might have been around 2014, 2015. I know it was before the 2016 election for sure.
Okay. So it's been a while, and I had a chance to meet
him. Time flies. It's this Corona time. Everything is moving quick.
Absolutely. Right. And I had a chance to meet you when I was more active in the Libertarian Party. And you probably, when we first met, I wasn't married to my wife, who I did meet in the Libertarian Party. But Alex, you and I have kind of been separated for several years simply because you went on to pursue a career in being an attorney. So you went to law school and, you know, you're now a lawyer. So, Alex, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael. And really, it's an honor to be on the show with you. I'm really honored to be invited as a guest and to share who I am and the work that I do and for your guests and your listeners. As you said, my name is Alex Jurcich. I'm a general practice attorney based in Carmel, Indiana. I'm originally from a little background on me. I think that's an important part to explain so to give context to why I think the way I do, why I do things the way I do. I'm originally from the former Yugoslavia. I'm a Serb from Croatia. I immigrated with my parents in October of 1990 at the outset of the war in Yugoslavia. We moved to the Chicagoland area. That's where I grew up. I went to college at DePaul. After college, I met my wife shortly after. She's also from Serbia. Brought her over. She immigrated to America. We got married, and then once we decided kind of what she wanted to do, we figured that Indiana was going to be the best place for both us to continue our education, pursue our careers and our professions, and also a place that we wanted to live. So we ended up here in Indiana. I graduated from law school at IU McKinney in Indianapolis. I worked for a mid-sized law firm for a little bit. After that, that was right around the time of Corona when I started. I had clerked at the firm, fantastic firm. Everything was great. I loved the environment. I loved the atmosphere. But I think COVID changed a lot of things for everybody and the way they look at things. And you and I kind of looked at those. We've kind of been on the forefront of those thanks to somebody that we both share and both listen to, Jason Stapleton. So those things were already in our minds. But, you know, when that all happened, there was a kind of a confluence of events, and this is kind of tied to my bio. I had graduated law school right before or right during COVID-19. So that March, two, 3 months before finals, before graduation, before getting my diploma, COVID happened and we went completely remote. So that was a shock. And then I took the Indiana bar, then the Illinois bar, and then got later, just actually this month, got waived into DC. So there's been a lot kind of happening. And that background, I'm telling you, because after the period in May at the firm that I was at, I was having a great time. I was learning a lot, but I just decided I want to do something else. It wasn't the career that I wanted to pursue. So when I said I was a general practice attorney, I opened up my own firm, Jurcich Law, based here in Carmel. And now that I have licenses in Indiana, Illinois, and DC, I'm able to kind of practice across there. And that's, we can kind of get into that stuff as well, why I chose to be here and the space that I chose to be in. But it's just, you know, that's kind of where I'm at and where I'm from. And now here in Carmel and enjoying my life, enjoying the my work finally, enjoying my practice, enjoying just being here in Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, and Indiana is a great state for those who are from that state. I'm from Illinois. When you compare and contrast the two, even from a legal perspective, Indiana is much more free than Illinois, I think.
It might be. I would maybe argue with you here. Now, when watching the example being set in Florida, I don't know if I would say Indiana's as free. I hope to get there. I was actually had a breakfast this morning with somebody, and we were chatting about what is preventing Indiana from taking the lead that Florida's doing. We have a majority Republican Congress, or, you know, General Assembly. We have, you know, it's a red state. There's no doubt about it. Apart from, you know, Northwest Indiana and Marion County, where Indianapolis is, we're almost all red. And so the question is, why are we not doing some things? And those, you know, that's kind of tied to why I wanted to do my own firm as well. I saw that there was kind of a void and people being willing to speak up, people being willing to stand out, people being willing to be politically incorrect. As much as the truth may be behind those statements that are politically incorrect, people just didn't want to do it. And so with my background being an immigrant, my grandparents were survivors of World War II concentration camps in Jasenovac as Serbian prisoners by the Ustashi. And them going through that period, surviving, luckily, not all my family survived. Then after that, going through the period of communism under Tito, and that, which was a let's say communism light compared to the rest of the Eastern Bloc, it was still no doubt about it, a authoritarian system. And after that, you know, kind of getting through that and the first Democratic elections, as the first Democratic elections come, you have some highly, highly nationalistic parties that are much different than the nationalist kind of movements that started in 1917. These were more kind of, let's say, borderline fascist. And so the war erupted as opposed to being able to kind of cooperate and respecting other people's autonomy, sovereign autonomy. The war broke out and we came to America. So I have a background that allows me to say some of the things that maybe other, and I'm going to be honest here, white heterosexual males tend to feel afraid to say. And we should be in America, a country that you can say these things, not because we want to be bad or evil in any way, but because in order to be able to make progress, we have to be able to communicate. We have to be able to talk and share ideas and figure out maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the other side is wrong. Maybe there's the middle ground is the right area. So, you know, that coming to Indiana was the initial attention. I saw things were a little bit different. In the current climate, things were difficult. So here I am now being willing to kind of be more open about my positions, the things that I feel. And even you know, this political aspect even started during law school. One of the things I didn't mention was during my third year, I actually co-founded what was called the Serbian American Leadership Conference. Mm-hmm. And that was an organization still there, but with my time crunch, it's a little bit difficult to juggle everything. It was an organization designed to increase civic engagement among the Serbian American community. And so I, with that, had started getting politically involved very much nationally. I met with a lot of Congress people, a lot of decision makers, congressional staff, heads of state, in Serbia, members of parliament in Serbia, members of heads of state of Republika Srpska and Bosnia and Herzegovina, ambassadors, crown prince of Serbia. I really got a lot of experience with that. And so that kind of paved the way for where I'm seeing this going is, well, I'm building this practice. I'd love to run for office here in Indiana. And that was this meeting's morning. This morning's meeting was actually a discussion about exploring a potential run as a state rep here where I live in the 39th district in central Indiana. So again, it's all connected. I think it's high time to speak up and be autonomous and take control of your income. And it's all kind of connected to your podcast, the podcast that we kind of listen to, the group of people that we're kind of making a community with. That's all very similar. It's people that want control of their income. They want to have autonomy, sovereignty over themselves, over their families, and form communities that are, you know, if the bigger picture is wanting to attack you or isolate you in some way, we need to form these communities. And I kind of had, again, tying back to my Serbian, that's why I kind of gave that long intro about where I'm from. Mm-hmm. Being Serbian, you know, we were very often demonized in the media during the 90s as being kind of the bad guy. And so we experienced the political correctness before anyone experienced. We experienced the lies from legacy media before the rest of America did. So when all this stuff here in 2016, 2015 started, people started waking up, Serbs were saying, hey, we know what's happening here. We experienced this, we've seen it. And a big part of us being able to get through that and a big part of me feeling confident growing up and speaking out on Serbian issues and Serbian American issues and all those things was the fact that one, we were always, I've had a history of being the outsider for one thing and being demonized. And two was I grew up in a community. The Serbian American community and the Serbian people were very, as much as we're divided, we've grown to be very together. We've grown a sense of community, a sense of culture, a sense of tradition. And these are things that have held us together throughout history, not just recently from 1990 on, but from the time of the Ottomans 500, 600 years ago. And the battle for independence there, and then World War I, World War II, everything that we've gone through. It's always been a sense of community, a sense of things that bring you together. And that was one of the things that were great about America is the fact that you had a sense of community. Regardless of the fact that you and I maybe view something differently, there was still the culture. There was still a framework that we agreed upon. Freedom, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, right? The rule of law. Those are all things that bring people together in a community as America. And that's the only way as America we can survive, considering the diversity that we do have, which is at times great, but at other times when it becomes not diversity and just becomes a buzzword, it's not what we want. So I know I've gone on a little bit of a tangent there, but just kind of given a background of the Indiana aspect and why I'm getting active with that.
Well, Alex, I think you covered every topic I wanted to cover, so we're going to end a podcast right here. No, I'm just kidding.
I apologize. That happens with me all the time. So
we definitely have a lot in common here. You know, I was thinking as we were talking, the cultural aspect of the United States of America is really what is suffering the most in today's world. And, you know, you and I have a similar interest that we want to help people become more free. And a person like yourself who, you know, is heavily, what's the word I'm looking for? Your time is heavily taken up by education and you know, in pursuing those degrees and passing the bar and starting a business. I don't see you a lot on social media, but we have connected over years. And the reason why I bring up social media is because that is just it's just a dumpster fire of ideas, especially on Twitter, you know, and in the liberty world perspective, particularly, you know, you have some people who follow that persuasion who want to follow the law, want to follow the system, want to see if they can make changes in the system. I'll call those people libertarians, you know, people who are involved in a political system. And I'm not using that word.
Got a big L or a little L?
Well, there is that. There's a big L and there's a little L. Okay. There's a libertarian party, but then there's a libertarian little L, which I think is more, like I mentioned, is more the political minded person, more who wants to get into the system to turn the nuts and bolts to see what kind of changes can be made within the system. I'm going to categorize myself outside of that. You know, we met in the Libertarian Party, but lately I haven't really been too involved or too interested in the political aspect. You mentioned Jason Stapleton a little bit, and I think this is his mantra. And for those listening to the podcast, I know I've talked a lot about Jason Stapleton's Nomad Network for a while. But the reason why I bring it up is because there are a lot of people in there who are trying to make a change, but see the real strategy in developing themselves first, developing the skills necessary to take the next step in their lives, developing themselves, maybe on a business perspective, wanting to, you know, solve some kind of problem. And then of course there is this battle going on in social media about those kind of people versus the people who want to get into the system. Are you aware of that going on? Have you noticed that at all, Alex?
I mean, absolutely. What you do notice is the people that want to get in the system are the people that want to have power over others. And I think people like us, want to have just power over ourselves, you know, and we're not interested in controlling others. We're not interested in exerting power over others through these institutions. And that's where this big difference is. And I think our culture, tying back to what you said with our culture has gone to the point where if you do want to have power over yourself, you're shunned. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a male, you're told to, you know, one of my big, along with Jason Stapleton is obviously Dr. Jordan Peterson. I think Dr. Jordan Peterson, Jason Stapleton, kind of these health biohacking type people that, and you know, tech forward, tech progressive people are all essentially coalescing into one group, the cryptocurrency, the Bitcoin group. It's all becoming one big group community of people seeking power over themselves. And why I say that is because of this narrative. That we are being told that as males, you cannot, you know, your masculinity is toxic. Mm-hmm. Your masculinity is something that oppresses, as opposed to looking at things in the context of history and looking at things in the context of what masculinity is itself. It's about being competent. That's what masculinity is. Masculinity is about strength and being providing and protecting people. That doesn't mean that others can't protect themselves or females can't protect themselves. It just means that everyone has a different role. We are social beings. And in order to do that, we have to perform those roles to have a functioning society. And part of the reason that we're in this chaos that we're living in, regardless of your perspective, whether you're on the left and you're looking at the right as you know, these January 6th insurrectionists and fascists, or whether you're on the right and looking at the left as being these woke fascists as well, woke communists, you know, looking to take over and have a society where with no rules and anarchy, it doesn't matter. There's something, this chaos is being created by this void of us trying to suppress who we are inherently. And you know, that's the problem with that is what that's allowed is by pushing down masculinity and strength and competence, it's allowing bad actors to come up to seep through the cracks and take power. And now we are seeing that. We're seeing that with the control through these different channels, the social media, as you said. You know, there's right. a reason that all these things are becoming so toxic, because if you're overcome with hatred and focused on everybody else other than yourself, and you don't have a support system, you don't have a community, who else is there to rely on but the people that are in control and they tell you to rely on?
Sure.
Rely on the state, rely on this institution, rely on whatever the buzzword, Dr. Fauci, you know, whatever it may be at the moment, that's what they're trying to push.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jordan Peterson, and that's one of the struggles that we hear in culture is the hierarchies, right? There's a difference between a power hierarchy, and Jordan Peterson eloquently explains the competence hierarchy, right? And so, you know, especially when you relate it to a free market type of economy, competence is important, right? You want to hire a plumber that can stop the leaks. You want to hire a mechanic that can fix your car and make sure your brakes stop the car. You want to hire an attorney that is competent and understands the legal system that been actually is not jaded by the system, right? And so all these things, you know, progresses one up a hierarchy, but it's not because they crave powers, but because people want to know that when they go get a service, that they're getting the best service they can possibly get, that responsibilities are met. That's another word that is mentioned in this conversation is responsibility is lacking.
Responsibility right. is lacking, and not only that, it's like almost counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. You know, the side that's talking about progress is wants to destroy a hierarchy which allows for progress, because you have to have a competence hierarchy for progress. Mm-hmm. You want to have the best people building and creating and bringing other people value, making themselves valuable to themselves, to their families, to their community. Otherwise, you're gonna regress. And that's what we're seeing. That's what the Jordan Peterson message is. That's what the Jason Stapleton message. That's what our message, I think, yours with Invictus Mind, you know, being unconquered. And the fact of being unconquered is the fact of wishing to progress up that hierarchy itself, because you want to make society better. I mean, it's all kind of interconnected, what we're seeing today.
Right. Now, something in you a long time ago must have thought that you wanted to be a lawyer, right? It wasn't like a last minute thing, right? Is this something that you wanted to do since you came to the United States with your family and knowing their extensive background? You want to be one of those that understands the freedom that we have and kind of fights for it, right? Is that the reason why you decided law school?
Absolutely. And it's tied with Jason Stapleton, you know, talks a lot about, and I'm an Orthodox Christian, so I don't sometimes believe in destiny too much. Right. I believe that God doesn't, he knows all, but doesn't predetermine. But I think there's things that are a calling. Mm. And from a young age, being an attorney was a calling for me. And it started because of my Serbian background. And that's why I kind of gave that long intro and back and forth about all those things, because it's all tied to who I am today.
Right.
From, you know, there was, when there was the bombing of Serbia in 99, I wore a target patch pin for the 78 days. And I was in seventh grade. And I wore a patch. You know, my first year in high school, we started talking about World War I and Gavril Princip and the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. And I knew that how the narrative was being switched. I went home that day. I went printed out a bunch of the books and papers that I had. I brought it to school the next day. I stood up in class and I spoke about that. I've always had these things that naturally came to me that led me to this profession, whether it's advocating for a position, whether it's I was active in speech and drama. I enjoyed acting. I danced folklore. There was always something about a performance aspect, an advocacy aspect. And I was always tied with the political side. Politics, the law, you know, when we had family parties or get-togethers with others, I didn't play with the kids. Don't get me wrong. I loved sports. I was really good basketball player, soccer player. I played my first year in college of basketball. So I was a good athlete, but when it came time to these parties and the older adults got together and they were talking politics, history, and law, I wasn't with the kids. I was sitting
grown-up table.
That's right. I was sitting intently with the grown-ups listening, not because of that, for any reason that I was forced to stay there, but because I actually enjoyed it. And, okay. And so that was the tie for me wanting to be an attorney. Was that passion for what I say is nothing other than a calling, doing your best in what you know that you can do well in order to improve society. And that's, yeah. I think, a message that we can, resonates with everyone.
You mentioned at the top that there was a lot of changes that took place. Obviously, because of COVID-19, everybody had some kind of changes in their industry. But what specifically changed when COVID hit? I mean, because you said you set yourself on a path to work for a firm, and somewhere along the line, you decided that you were going to be a solo practitioner instead. Was COVID a direct response to that, or just because you saw the change in the way people think about, I guess, law and the society we live in? What was the catalyst that made you change?
I think it was the confluence of all three of those factors, you know, COVID, culture, and the law itself. Okay. And in terms of COVID, it just, I guess there would even be a hierarchy for that. COVID was the instigator for the aspects of culture and the law that I saw that needed change. And so COVID pushed the button on that and making me realize that I loved the firm. As I said, I loved the firm that I was at, but I was a civil litigator, defense litigation in the transportation and premises liability group. Great group, but I'm not enacting change there. You know, I was working for insurance companies and defending drivers and motor carriers and insurance companies and you know, some big retail, national retailers on the premises liability side. And it was great work. I was learning a lot, invigorating, but at the same time, I was thinking, I have to be professional. I can't speak up about the things that are happening in society. I can't advocate for the things that I want, not just because I can't speak up, because I just don't have the time. So even if I do want to do some things, I can't do them. I just don't have the time. It was very much more than a full-time job. And so it was making a decision of, when COVID hit, wow, things are accelerating. That cultural side is changing. I need to speak up. And as I started practicing, I realized the law is outdated in so many ways. Not to say the Constitution, I'm a firm believer in the Constitution, but the practice of law itself is outdated. What are we as attorneys doing to bring value to society? Are we just there to act as, you know, to litigate and foster this litigious society that we've kind of grown into? Or are we the people that we should be? The people that stand for justice, that stand for the truth, that advocate for the downtrodden, that advocate for the oppressed, that advocate for what's right when everyone else is too afraid to speak up, that we are the ones that speak up because we have the knowledge, we have the background, we have the procedural knowledge to do the things that we need to do to move forward, whether it's through the courts, whether it's through our legislative system, whatever it may be, we are the ones that do that. And so I just saw that the attorneys need to be starting to do something else, but also the practice itself is not adapting quick enough. Technology is rapidly adapting and moving and progressing. And the law and the practice of law is not. It's antiquated. These large firms are so big, and we see it in our government. These firms are so big, they cannot make the changes quick enough to adapt and to adjust. And I started following a small group of attorneys that are very tech forward, tech lawyers, very involved in crypto. They're very startup involved. And I noticed that they just thought about things differently. They were thinking outside the box. It wasn't, the client tells me what to do and I'm just going to do that. And that's my job. It was more, how do I bring value to the client himself? How do I bring value to whatever endeavor the client is working on and become a partner in that? Not as somebody that's telling you what you should do, but as somebody that's creating with you right? And that's where we're at. We're in the creation economy, the value economy.
Right. So now you can pick and choose the cases that you want to tend to, and you know, you don't have someone's thumb on your head saying that, you know, we're going to put you on this case and you're going to do this for us. Being a solo practitioner, you know, you feel like you have a much nobler role in helping the, like you said, downtrodden, the people who really need to get proper representation because the system has their thumb on their head.
Absolutely. I've been shocked to see, look, the practice of law, the attorneys today are overwhelmingly, and this is something that conservatives, libertarians, populists, sovereign thinkers need to start realizing. And I have a great colleagues, but our profession is overwhelmingly left-leaning. Arguably 90% in my perspective. Now, whether more are keeping it quiet, that's one thing, but that is going that way. And my class was overwhelming me that way. Not that there are bad people, but those are things that we need to start thinking about, that rule of law is the basis of our society. It's what separates us from the rest. If people don't have confidence in the rule of law, we cannot have a functioning society. We cannot have, we cannot rely on anything. And that's part of the thing, you know, watching with these vaccine mandates and the disregard of bodily autonomy, you know, the way that we see with the Rittenhouse case and some of these other cases where, you know, judges are being threatened by Antifa and by BLM and these people, just and anarchists, people just interested in causing trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's casting doubt on the one institution that we need to have as the last defense of our society. And, you know, these are I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent again, but it's having the ability to do, being free and a sole practitioner allows me to be able to take on those cases, because a lot of the big firms, a lot of these bigger attorneys, they're not interested in doing these kind of things. Sure. And not either out of fear or out of the fact that they just don't believe in that.
Yeah, I like how you mentioned rule of law, because, that was what the basis of the Constitution is. Now, there are those who will argue about the merits of the Constitution, and I don't want to have that conversation. But it does set up a precedent for our society, a rule of law, right? The government has to follow or is supposed to follow certain things that are written in that Constitution. We now see a society where we have rule of man, right? Whatever the king says, or, you know, the president in this case, right? King Biden, I'll call him, right? He just opens his mouth and all of a sudden 80 million Americans are concerned about their job. And that's just ridiculous. And what kind of representation do these people have? Well, like you mentioned, if you're going through a big firm who is left-leaning, then the narrative is going to be shifted heavily in favor of the, you know, what the president wants, rather than somebody who, you know, doesn't have that ideology, or, you know, doesn't have that proper representation. They're going to go to somebody like you, say, hey, you know, Alex on my side, I can trust him. He's not part of one of these big firms who's just in it for the money, but you know, they're going to take care of my needs.
Yeah. Someone that believes in you and wants to help you. Again, right. It's bringing value to your client in every way, whether it's protecting their rights, whether it's helping them build their business, being, you know, if the business is outside the box, for example, in the crypto industry, that's where I'd like to see my practice moving, is in the crypto industry, because they're thinking outside the box. They're incentivized about freedom and liberty. And those, a lot of these firms either don't understand it or they don't want to fight the system as it is. Right. Okay. And that's part of the problem. You know, this morning I was reading, Reuters Legal sends out like a morning docket, and it's kind of a breakdown. And I saw again this morning that another judge ordered that some of these attorneys that were defending, that were challenging some of the elections, were fined again. And this is like it was like 187,000 or 180,000. And there was another case. So another judge did the same thing. It was a similar amount. And it's setting like a dangerous precedent of where we're going. By you, so not only are you having judges being threatened, you're having attorneys being afraid to pursue these things that might be good. You know, now it's these, you know, hot topic issues, politically divisive, but in 5 years, it's not going to be a hot topic issue. It's going to be something like, how can you build your crypto industry? How can you build your business in the 21st century where, you know, remote work is going, you know, and there's things that are going to come up that we might not even think about. And somebody might be afraid to challenge because we've started to build this culture of fear to represent people. And lawyers shouldn't have to fear that. Attorneys should not have to fear that in any way. And clients and the people shouldn't have to fear that their attorneys are afraid of that. It casts too much doubt in every part, from the client to the attorney to the courts.
Right. So we're seeing institutions fail us left and right, and that can't be good for society.
Correct.
So Alex, so I know that you have attorney-client privilege, so I'm not going to ask you specific details, but what kind of general cases do you handle in your solo practice?
At this early point, I'm still a young attorney, still trying to build the work and the clientele, but I'm doing a lot of business related, you know, helping form businesses, start businesses, helping maintain those businesses if they already have them. I'm working on a couple personal injury cases from that end, and I worked on a couple of real estate deals. And so those are, again, wide ranging at the moment, but it's the fact that I'm able to choose that, and the fact that I'm trying to build something different. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew when I made the decision to leave the firm, firm life is a nice deal. You get a nice salary, you get your benefits, mm-hmm. you have mentors all around, you have the resources all around, you're not taking a loss, you have the clients already there for you. It's a pretty good life. You know, you just have to work hard. So there's that aspect, but being on your own, it kind of all changes all that. But the law is going to adapt and the practice is going to adapt. And so I wanted to help create something that could be a firm that could go along with those trends, not be afraid, be outside the box.
Okay.
And being able to adapt regardless of the situation. For one example, one of the reasons that with my solo practitioner, with my firm, my office is I'm working with a co-working space. So the co-working space that I have an office at, it gives me so much flexibility. As I mentioned, I have the Indiana license, I have Illinois and DC, and having that co-working space allows me to move, you know, so I'm here based in Carmel all the time, but when I have clients in Illinois, I'm able to use the other space that this co-working company owns. So I can go there, and they have like 8 locations. So I can go to any one of those locations. I can meet with a client. I can adapt. I can go to DC. They have also a large amount of these offices in DC. I can go meet with a client. It's like having a gym membership. If you're a Lifetime, for example, right? You can go lift in Lifetime in Orland Park. You can go lift in Lifetime in Schaumburg or Naperville or wherever they have them. And so you have the ability to kind of do that. And that's the same thing with these co-working spaces. You do that. And having that remote, and that's across industries, as we've seen with the COVID. And this is before COVID, people realized like the trend is going to be remote no matter what. It's just COVID increased it because everyone had to be remote. And so now we're seeing people start to go back and start to, some are doing hybrid models, some are going back, but I want to have the flexibility that if I want to be fully remote, I can be fully remote. Now, the question is whether the courts are going to adapt to that. Probably not for most of the time. But I think in some cases where the courts, you know, have to stay is like in-person trial. I think that's something that you want to have in person. There's something to having a jury trial and jury being able to see you and being able to argue in person. But for a lot of these other aspects, there's no reason that you can't be remote. And having that ability is great, but it's great for more reasons. Because whether we like it or not, I believe for a fact that this current way we practice of having attorneys being licensed in one jurisdiction or another, and that being it, I think those days are going to go away because it's going to move to a multi-jurisdictional practice. Mm. Our clients are multi-jurisdictional.
Right.
They're expanding their businesses everywhere. They're expanding all across the United States. They have offices in different places. You know, and some of these cases, you know, filing something with a state is not as difficult as it was back in the 1800s early 20th century when, you know, you were an attorney just in your little local area, you did your little route and that was it. You know, we're in a different time. Then you needed to have that jurisdictional aspect. Then you needed to have a bar association within each jurisdiction kind of ensuring the competence of those of each people in there, because one, the laws were different. Two, they were limited. And three, we didn't have the technology that we had. You know, the one of the things with the bar, now I'm a big advocate of actually changing the bar exam itself, is that it was built for that antiquated system. It was built for a system where you don't have the research. You don't have some of these legal research software programs to be able to go and look at something. What you had to do was you had to absorb and learn all this information as much as you could. And you had to take that information, you know, pass the bar for it. You had to regurgitate it, because you needed to, when you met with a client, you needed to have that all information in your head. You didn't have something that you can do like a quick search on. You needed to know it. And you couldn't, and if you did want to do some research and with the court cases and other things, you had to be limited to one practice area, for example, because there was so much adapting. You had to go to a law library, right? You had to have, you actually had to go from one book to another, and it was time consuming to do all of those things. It was just different. And now the practice is changing completely.
So now with the advent of technology and the research readily available, you can, rather than being a specialist, you can be a general practitioner, right?
You can
take different types of cases out. Now I know that there's probably thousands of different things or avenues you can take in the legal profession. You're dealing mainly with contracts, and you mentioned businesses and things of that nature. Have you any experience in the courtroom, you know, in a jury trial?
No jury trials yet. I do have one next year. Smaller claim, not big, but it's something that I'm looking forward to. I did that a lot in law school. I was a part of a program through the Southern District of Indiana, the Federal District Court, where it was called the REACH program. Was the Reentry and Community Health Program. Again, something I'm very passionate about was reforming, ending the drug war, for example, ensuring that the people that are charged with drug crimes or nonviolent crimes, that they aren't stuck punished unfairly, unjustly. And so through that, I had some access to the courts. I was active in some of these moot court programs and the like, and took, you know, trial practice courses. But outside of that, I didn't get the experience. But the thing is, these days, you don't even really have to have the experience. I think the statistic is 97% of cases don't even go to trial anymore.
Right,
unless it's a criminal charge, you're not going to trial. You're going to be settling early on. Most of the time, you know, before even depositions or shortly after depositions, depending on whatever it is. And if it does get even through the deposition side, it doesn't settle, then you get to the summary judgment side of it. And, you know, usually courts are ruling for summary judgment. So there's all these steps that are stopping it from getting to trial. And actually, that's a pretty good thing, because the courts, as they are, even considering the fact that 97% or I think it was 97 or 96, something like that, of cases aren't going to trial, the courts are still extremely backed up. And these cases are taking a long time to, you know, 2-3 years to resolve themselves, if they do even get that far. Even the ones that settle sometimes take a long time to do so, because, you know, the whole process of exchanging files, exchanging facts, the deposition portion, you know, the negotiations, the motion side, the summary judgment side, you know, setting out the terms for the trial itself. It all takes a long time to do. And so I don't know if we can change that aspect, but the other aspects, I think, you know, can change.
Well, I want to focus in on a word that you said, which I might push back a little bit, because you said it was a good thing that the court system's taken so long. Now, my understanding of constitutions, we have a right to a speedy trial.
Correct.
Now, with all the paperwork and litigation and settlement discussions, you know, it seems like that could greatly divide people into a class system. You know, those who have a lot of money, who can afford an attorney to you know, go through all these different meetings, all these different litigation processes, rather than going right to a trial, right? It seems like, you know, especially if somebody has more money, is more wealthy, and can take advantage of somebody who doesn't have enough resources, that could be heavily favored in, you know, against the wrong party. And so why would you say that was a good thing? I was just curious about that.
I apologize if I misspoke on that. Not that it's a good thing that trials take that long.
Okay.
I'm saying it's a good thing maybe that they don't go to trial for the fact that the courts are so overburdened. Now, if we can figure out a way to And that's another thing I'm very interested in. One of the things, even on a trial aspect, is going to have to change. Okay. And I'm glad you brought that up on the speedy trial aspect. I think we need to start moving into more of what is like a private law type deal, where not necessarily private law, but more arbitration, more mediation. And that those are things that our courts are already starting to adopt. The fact that, you know, some courts require like a mandatory arbitration. A lot of contracts have mandatory arbitration. You know, Cook County, for example, has mandatory arbitration if you request a jury civil trial, and I believe it's below 30,000. You go to mandatory arbitration. That mandatory arbitration, if I remember correctly, forgive me, not legal advice. I should have probably prefaced this whole conversation. This is not legal advice, but. If I remember correctly, it's three attorneys that are appointed as a panel that'll act as mandatory arbitration. And then once it goes through that process, then it can go forward to a jury trial. So there are ways that courts are adapting. It's just, we need to start doing that, I think, a lot quicker. And I think the speedy trial aspect is courts are still kind of hesitant to adapt all these things that we've kind of gone through during the pandemic of being remote. You know, some judges are requiring going back to hearings, and I get it. You know, some judges still have their way, and there's reasons for that. But let's see if we can build some kind of system to integrate the law. Let's be more efficient. Let's ensure that, as you said in the Constitution, let's ensure that we can get a speedy trial, that we can move quickly and efficiently. And maybe the fact that we move that way, it'll prevent us or bring us back from where we're at of being so overly litigious that everything is kind of, you know, the first thing people think is I'm going to sue you. Right. Mm-hmm. And as an attorney that, you know, people may be shocked by that, but I hope we can get to a point where we don't need me, you know, let's get to a society where there's a way that we can cooperate and function efficiently without having it always go to the first thing that you think about when something goes wrong is, well, I'm going to sue you, you know?
You live on a kind of like a double-edged sword there, because when someone's in trouble, they want a competent lawyer who can take care of them, who knows the system, who knows how to get through and protect that defendant, right? Provided that he's not in the wrong, right? If you have right. somebody who's actually a victim of the system, they want a competent lawyer. On the other hand, you know, people tend to hate lawyers who are in this system, who are like, okay, I'm going to throw everything at the book at you because, you know, I have all my lawyer firm buddies that, you know, are informing me about this and that. You look at prosecutions, you mentioned the drug war, you know, the prosecutors who are getting compensated directly for going through that process, you know, getting people in trouble. No, I try not to pay attention too much to the legal system, except that, you know, it is very convoluted. And yes. Like I mentioned, you know, you can be a good guy who understands the system, who wants to help the little guy, or you can be one of those other types of lawyers that people tend not to like too much.
Right. But that's the thing. Attorneys shouldn't be somebody that you don't like. They should be people that are advocating for you. That should be a positive thing in our society. Someone that's helping you navigate the laws, helping you get through a dispute, helping you, you know, solving a problem. That's the kind of attorney I want to be. You know, one of my slogan is innovation, insight, and integrity. And the innovation side is having innovative solutions. And mm-hmm. that's what attorneys should be. They should be problem solvers. And I think we are taught that in law school, to be problem solvers. That's the number one way to help clients. But it's just, there's the system that we're in is not conducive to that. And again, there are structural reasons for that, and there are, you know, human reasons for that and others, but it's the time that we need to start thinking out of the box and figure out how we can improve that, so that we get to the point where people say being an attorney is a great thing. I have an attorney friend, it's a great thing, and we're not the butt of the jokes, we're you know, the people that people believe in mm-hmm. as being friends, as being advocates and helpers in some way.
Sure.
Problem solved.
So I want to share a story of something that I experienced vicariously through my wife. So she got the mail, the thing in the mail that said you have to serve jury duty.
My wife did recently too, by the way.
And so
she was devastated.
Well, right. So I've been thinking about this lately because, you know, we talked about it a little earlier. You know, you have some of these high narrative, high profile cases out there, where having jury selection is extremely important, because no matter which way the court case goes, it seems like the whole country will shift one way or the other, right? On the other hand, you know, somebody who doesn't want to, you know, give up their time at work or something like that, he wants to get out of jury duty. And so I was pretty funny because my wife got that thing in the mail and, you know, she went down to Chicago. It was actually a federal case. It wasn't local for her county, so it was a federal case. And she went down there and, of course, they have to go through the vetting system. They ask her a bunch of questions, what her ideology is, what her belief system is. And depending on how they how she answers, you know, decides whether she's going to be on a jury or not. So apparently, and I'm going to throw her under the bus here. Not really. I love my wife. She, you know, she, her and her, you know, libertarian ideology said all the wrong things, you know, from a legal perspective. And, you know, they said, we don't want your services. We don't want you to be on the case. So she was happy. She didn't have to do that. On the other hand, if it was a high profile case, you know, somebody who doesn't want to be there, we want somebody who understands the law, who understands the system, who understands how to defend people. So, I mean, what do you think about that whole vetting system in, you know, for jury selection? Because it seems like if we're really supposed to be a system of we the people, the attorneys kind of decide, you know, who is part of that we, who's a good person to be on a case, who's a bad person.
You know, we could do an entire podcast just on that topic alone. And we discuss that often in law school as well. That's a topic. Does the jury system as we currently have it work? I think overall that it works. The voir dire process and, you know, the vetting allows the attorneys to kind of needle out the people that may have a bias or a preconceived notion about a certain position, or they may have some kind of conflict or some kind of background experience that'll taint their perspective of the facts of the case themselves and the evidence that's going to be presented to them. Mm-hmm. So those are things that you do want to have attorneys who already recognize the evidence, know what the evidence is going to be out there, can kind of weed out. To prevent those kind of things from happening. And now the problem is, once you get to the trial, I think there's two problems. One trial related, one culturally related, that where we're in now, and we kind of touched on earlier. The trial related part is, so, okay, we get a jury of our peers that is coming in clear-minded, fairly, as much as we can. We were humans, right? There was always going to be some kind of influence on us in some way, right? Mm-hmm. Wealth, power, and influence from Jason Templeton. So there's always some kind of influence that's affecting us. But mm-hmm. For the most part, you're having someone that's neutral. But then the question becomes the law itself, the rules of the game. Can those lay people understand some of these complicated laws, some of the rules? And sometimes even attorneys having a hard time understanding. That's why we have jobs. That's why we have opposing sides that can argue this is the way it should be looked at. And you have the other side saying this is the other way. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think the problem becomes, where sometimes it can be too complicated. And in the society we live in, our laws have expanded so much over time. It's become so difficult to stay up on and to understand. I mean, we're passing, for example, what the Build Back Better bill is, I forget how many pages, thousands of pages, you know, these are laws that are on the books that you can get in trouble for, right? These are things that we should be able to know. And when you have 1,000 pages just for one set of laws being passed, one bill that's being passed, imagine for combining everything. So that's the hard part. And then the cultural part is the one that we discussed. The pressure from the outside is one. You know, there's all these influences. You know, they caught the guy, what was it? Allegedly not tied to NBC. We don't know, but he was like following the jury and they're feeling pressure. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's going to happen after that? Can they be revealed? That's a problem. That could taint the jury itself. You know, the fear of ruling one way or another, because it might be unpopular or someone might attack you for that. That's problematic. It's also problematic because of the fact that we are connected. We have cell phones, we have internet, we have the news at our hands, social media. You know, you can look up a case, you can follow the news on some of these things. And so some courts are now grappling with, how do you balance the fact that a juror can look up an attorney? look at their background, look at their social media, that a juror can look up a case.
That prompts a question, Alex. So
yeah, please.
I was having this discussion with actually my brother-in-law about, I'm going to mention Kyle Rittenhouse. That was the latest high profile case, but you look at something like that and it's nationally televised, right? They have reporters in the courtroom, and then you have other cases that are not televised. And so is that determined on a court by court basis, or is that a federal versus state basis? How does that work, whether they televise a case or not?
Be quite honest, I don't know the details on that as much. If my understanding is correct, most federal cases are not able to be recorded and shown. Some courts allow you to do so. Other courts don't allow you, depending on the case itself. So some courts, like if it's a criminal case, they won't allow you to do so. So it's a complicated system, which is kind of what I guess the theme of this whole thing is we have a complicated system that a lot of people don't understand, and that if we are one nation, maybe we should figure out a way to unify that, at least have one set of rules, whether it's adopting and I'm a very much a pro-federalist person. So I believe in federalism, but it complicates things. You know, is there a way maybe we can adopt the federal rules across the board in some way? It's going to be difficult to do, but these are all things that at least we need to start thinking about, and attorneys need to start innovating on, and courts. And these are things that courts and judges are doing all the time. And these ethics committees and bar associations, they're looking at ways to change the law, you know, adapt the practice of law, adapt how, you know, what the rules of procedure are. You know, they send out surveys, for example. So I may be doom and gloom in the way that I'm looking at things, but I think that our system works most of the time. It's just now I'm getting worried that we're getting to a point where maybe it's not going to work. And so if we don't start speaking up soon enough, it might not work, or it might get so complicated and so difficult that it's gonna fail. So I just want to clear that up. But you know, they are doing things. So you know, I get surveys. You know, attorneys get surveys all the time from courts asking, "What do you think about?" For example, you know, we were talking about the fact that a speedy trial, the number of interrogatories that you can get, the questions that you can send to another attorney. You know, courts will ask you about that. They'll say, "Well, you know, should we cut these down? What do you think about it? Is it too much, too little? Should we expedite the amount of time that you have to respond to these interrogatories or to write the interrogatories?" You know, these are all things that courts are still very on top of, and there's a lot of great people practicing and a lot of great judges and a lot of leaders in the law that are thinking about these things in different ways. So it's not doom and gloom. It's just, you know, my point was here to tell people that about the different nuances that are occurring right now, and the things, the way the law is maybe being antiquated, and the ways that it is adapting, and the way that it will adapt, you know, with the way that, we're getting into smart contracts. You know, there's a lot of great legal thinkers now, some of these crypto blockchain tech people, tech attorneys, tech lawyers that are thinking about how is smart contracts and how is that going to change the way that we practice it. One of the professors, his name is Aaron Wright. He wrote a book, I believe it's called Blockchain and the Law. And what it talks about is, I've just started reading it, so I can't give you a full thing, but the idea is that, you know, code is going to become law eventually. You know, our legal system itself is going to be coded into algorithms and codes, and that's going to regulate the way that we interact. And, you know, the terms of contracts are going to be filled in that way. And they're going to be, you know, once the parties fulfilled the both sides of their deal, you know, the contract gets executed itself, you know, and payout is paid, let's say, for example, or whatever it may be. So there's a lot of things that are happening. And it's just important, I think, that for you know, regular American citizens understand how the system that protects them, the system that they can rely on, that they should be able to rely on, is going to change, and it's going to adapt, and so that they can have a voice in that conversation, that they can understand how things are working, and they can avoid being told what it is rather than thinking about it themselves, you know, saying that it's, especially now with the way that narratives are created, it's easy to just fall into a narrative and say, this is how it must be because they said it. you know, the goal is in our society, we want to have people that can think on their own and that are critical thinking and that are responsible, that are self-sufficient. That's a society that we want to live in. And so that's where the law, we want to have more advocates both in the law and in the general public that are thinking about the law in that way.
So in layman's terms, we want more good guys in the legal profession than bad guys.
I guess we could put it that way. Not to say that there are bad guys out in the legal profession.
I don't want to dwell on that too much. It's more tongue in cheek, but I really am excited to learn more about some of these smart contracts you're talking about. You know, that is beyond my comprehension level right now, but I I've had Donnie Gebbert on here and he talked about a direct republic, and how everything will just be, like you said, contractual basis, but because of the smart contracts where, you know, you fulfill one part of the contract and it pays out. And I think that there's a lot of potential there. I'm going to have to try to get, you know, a different person who's more experienced in that to have a conversation, because I've been hearing about that term for a long time, the smart contract. And I think that what seems to be happening with technology is they're trying to pull out the human part of the legal system and making it more technologically, more, you know, more definite based, I guess would be probably the appropriate way of doing it.
Yeah. And there are pros and cons to that as well. You know, we do want to have a human, I think we still want to not lose our humanity in the law, because there are circumstances where, you know, you want to think, even if we have a law on the books, that's what we do in law school. We read the cases that always are on the edge of that line, and it's figuring out on that line, you know, which way does it fall, and you know, you fell outside that line just enough where you're guilty or you're at fault, but you know, maybe morally or as from the human aspect, maybe you shouldn't have been. So okay, you know, those are the things that we need to figure out, and how are we going to integrate that into a system where law is code and code is law. And there are a lot more, as you said, a lot more people that are that is in itself is a complicated topic discussion.
When you're dealing with morality, legality, and ethics, it's you know, there's a lot to talk about there.
Essentially, three teams of people.
Right. Exactly. So let me end with this thought right here, Alex. Has there been a high profile case or historical case maybe that you just wish that, you know, you could have been part of that, you know, maybe changed the way the country is moving?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that you throw me for a loop on that one. I don't, if I can think about it, I don't know. I don't know. I think one of the more important ones and that are on point here is, the name is skipping my mind right now at the moment. But it's the internment, Japanese internment camp case.
Okay.
And that case has never actually been overruled by our Supreme Court. Hmm. And so if I could go back, I think I would wish to be able to either advocate on that case or be a judge if I was lucky enough, smart enough to do that. I think that would be the case, because it set a dangerous precedent. And I think we're seeing that precedent kind of play out right now. In certain ways, with the ways that we're, at least in Australia, with the way that they're kind of having these quarantine camps, and you know, some people are saying it's okay, some people are saying it's not. But I think that case, and the way it was ruled upon, and the context of our society, and how divided it is now, and the way that we see some of those maybe similar themes happening in other similar legal systems and countries, and if we say Western, right? Australia, what I guess was deemed Western. That's something that I wish I could go back now and maybe have a part of, because it may have an influence down the line here shortly. I hope not, but I think that's a big one that I would, among the, obviously from the 19th century and even one of the cases that a lot of people talk about for the vaccine mandates, I think it was Jacobson. Is it Jacobson v. Massachusetts, if I remember correctly? That was, a lot of courts use that. You know, a lot of these people today use that case as like a basis. But if they've read that case, it's shocking of what the judge wrote, the justice wrote in that case, in terms of, I think it was forced sterilization of some mentally disabled or mentally ill. I think if I remember the facts of that case correctly, and you know, it was just shocking the way that the judge wrote about it. I think that would be a second one. And those, I think, both are relevant in the context of where we are today with COVID-19 and the mandates and the vaccines and the virus. And are we ever going to get out of this? And how are we going to move forward? And those two, I would say, probably would be the two main ones.
Well, great. Well, Alex, you're a good guy with a head on your shoulders. And, you know, I think you're doing good things in the world for people. Definitely, you know, you have a desire to help people, and you have a desire to, you know, really take control of your own destiny by, you know, being a solo business person. So why don't you go ahead and plug your stuff one more time, and we'll just give it a wrap right here.
Again, Michael, thank you so much for having me on the Evictus Mind. I'm very honored to be on here. You can find me, Alex Jurcich, at Alex Jurcich on every platform, essentially AlexDjuricic. Twitter, Facebook, Parler, Gab, all the above, LinkedIn. In some way, you can find me through that handle. I look forward to connecting with you. If you have any questions, anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out. I love to chat. Obviously, I'm all over the place. My mind's a million places. I'm very interested by a lot of things. So whether it's related to the law, culture, society, motivation, Nomad Network, the future, I'd love to chat with you and get to know you. So. Michael, thank you again.
All right. Alex, are you Evictus?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it. And you have a great day now.
Thank you, sir.
I want to thank everyone for sticking around and listening to the end of this program. I also want to thank Alex for taking his time to chat with us. Once again, as this year is winding down, I challenge everyone to take some time to reflect on the great things that transpired last year, the blessings you received, as well as the things that you look forward to doing next year. All it takes is a little planning, a little discipline, and surrounding yourself with great people, and the life that you want to live is a lot easier to achieve than you might think. So for now, continue growing, stay productive, stay blessed, and most of all, stay free. Have a good one. We'll see you next time.